Today, as you may know, is Tu Bishvat. If you don't know that, I'll tell you about it in a second. When I was a boy in the yeshiva in Harrisburg, on Tu Bishvat, or around there, if it turned out to be on Saturday, they would give us what they called buksa, which is what we think of as carob, but in its original state. It's very hard to eat. It tastes terrible. But it was actually a product of nature. And most of the food in the yeshiva was not. Our cook, whom we remember very well, her name was Mrs. Gardner. Mrs. Gardner was always concerned if we ate what she called your butter bread. Butter bread was white bread with all the nutrients carefully taken out. And a huge slab of butter spread over it. And the reason that they put butter on it was because all the oil had already been used in the cooking. So there was no oil left over for the bread. And this was what we ate in the yeshiva every day for lunch. And she really was very concerned that we finish our butter bread. And there was never any product that you would think of as natural, except for once a year we got this buksa that we were supposed to eat. But it was very hard to eat. And you got it for Tu Bishvat because Tu Bishvat was the holiday that celebrated trees. It was the new year for trees. And carob was, according to the tradition, also the food that sustained Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in the years that he hid in the cave from the Romans. So there was this tribute that the yeshiva paid to nature on this day by giving us this one hard piece of inedible carob, and that was how we celebrated the natural world. And the truth is that this was a continuation of a long tradition in Judaism, in which, after the Bible, the Jewish soul got put indoors. We don't think of it now, or perhaps we do, but the truth is, for most of Eastern European Jewish life, the model for what you should do is sit inside and study. I'm told, although I don't speak Yiddish and some of you do, and you'll have to let me know, that the Yiddish language is very poor in terms for the natural world. That it's hard, for example, in Yiddish to express the different kinds of trees. There's a tree, and a tree is a tree. And that's in part because the experience of Jews in the natural world was very limited. Our experience in the study hall was very great. But remarkably, that's not the case in the Bible. In the Bible, first of all, the world starts off in a garden. And not only does it start off in a garden, but a garden is the perfect place. And the one thing that is mentioned in the garden is a tree. And so you begin the Torah by realizing that the ideal place for a human being to be is actually outside, in a garden with a tree, not inside in a schoolroom with a book. That comes later. But you start off with the idea that human beings are in nature, a part of nature, and should be experiencing nature. And yet, that wasn't true for much of Jewish history. In the Torah itself, you realize almost all the action takes place outside. There's the garden, there's the flood, there's Sodom and Amorah, there's the wandering in the wilderness, there's the journeys to Egypt and the journeys back from Egypt. It's all outside action. We get really very little that takes place inside the tent, or even inside the Beit HaMikdash, inside the temple, which, by the way, was mostly outside. The courtyard was where most of the action took place, and that was outside, not inside. And yet, today, almost all of our worship takes place inside. And all the study that Judaism is known for took place inside. This began to change in the Jewish history around the 1800s when a couple of different groups started to go outside. First of all, the first to go outside were the Hasidim, who used to go alone in walks through nature, especially in the forests of Eastern Europe, and practice hitbodedut, which means aloneness. In other words, you would go alone into the woods and commune with God through nature. That was a very different idea from sitting alone in the study hall or with someone else and communing with God for a book. And the beginning of the rediscovery of nature not only spread, the Hasidim also gave birth in part to the Enlighteners, and the Enlightenment poets started to write nature poetry, which wasn't what Jews were known for. We didn't write about the natural world. Now, I just want a parenthesis. There's one exception to this, and that was during the Golden Age of Spain. Rabbi Shinlin, the former head of school of Sinai Akiva, his brother Ray Shinlin is an expert in medieval Hebrew poetry. And you want to know what his first book about the medieval poets of Spain is called? Wine, Women, and Death. Because that's what they were writing about, wine, women, and death. Not necessarily in that order, although often. But at that time, there was a little bit of nature poetry because it was the Golden Age of Spain, and the Arab poets, in fact, wrote about the outdoors, but really very little, and most Jewish poets wrote very complicated variations on the biblical stories. And in fact, on Yom Kippur, we have some of these piyutim in our prayer book, and when they talk about nature, they talk about nature in relation to God. But the Enlightenment poets started to write real nature poetry. Bialik, the greatest modern Hebrew poet, wrote about the world, because once he left the study hall, he discovered there was a vast world out there. And the others, of course, and this is what I want to focus on for a couple minutes, were the Zionists. Because the Zionists fell in love with the land. And when you fall in love with the land, you can't stay indoors. The whole point was, we may not remember it now, but when the early Zionists fell in love with the land, they actually fell in love with the land. That is, with planting, with sowing, with the kinds of fruit that Israel gave birth to. Aleph Dalet Gordon, who was sort of the Tolstoy of Israel, had this vision that all these Jews would come back to the land and work the land and reconnect with the soil, because for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, he felt, they had been sitting in yeshivot, knowing the book, but never knowing the world. And so the idea of Zionism wasn't originally software startups. That came later. The original idea was actually the land itself. And that great reconnection went back to the Bible. It's one of the reasons why the Zionists, like Ben-Gurion, loved the Tanakh so much, because the Bible was about the land. It wasn't only about the book. And so Jewish tradition, in a way, came full circle. It was outside, then for a long time it was inside, and then it came outside again. In fact, one of the great Zionist thinkers, Pinsker, said the Jewish people was a ghost. They were a spirit without a body. And they needed to go back to the land of Israel to rediscover the Jewish body, to become full people again, to become flesh as well as spirit. And so Tu B'Shvat became a big holiday again, even though it was really a minor holiday. It's not mentioned in the Torah. It's a rabbinic holiday. Even though it was a minor holiday, it became important again, because once again, Jews had fruit trees. And they had the land. And the symbol of the tree was not only Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, which originally was in a garden, but what did we turn it into? A book. Because we talk about the Torah as Eitz Chaim, right? We get up in front of the ark. As we put the Torah away, we go Eitz Chaim Hi, which means the Torah is a tree of life. Now, why do you make a tree into a book? in part because you no longer have a tree. But once you rediscover it, then you have both. You have both the natural world and the intellectual world. And that is in part what Zionism and what Israel gave back to the Jewish people, is the possibility of reconnecting with the world itself, not only with our representations of the world. But here is the last point, now that we've taken this quick nature trip through Jewish history, which fits on Tu B'Shvat, and it's not so often that we get to do it on Shabbat, inside, of course. I was thinking about that. I wondered what would happen if we went, if we brought everyone outside to pray on Wilshire Boulevard. It's not the right neighborhood for it. But here's the one difference about the Jewish appreciation for the natural world and what you might consider the everyday appreciation, which is if you go back to the Psalms talk about the world. Peharim rakaduche elim, the mountains skipped like rams. Hashamayim misaprim kavod el, the stars and the sky speak about God. And that's the difference, is when the Jewish tradition looks at nature, it looks at nature as a beautiful reflection of something infinitely more beautiful, and that is God. The natural world doesn't only exist for itself, it exists to lead us on to something more sublime, more transcendent, more ultimate, more infinite. So when you see a tree, when you see a mountain, when you look at the seas or the skies and you appreciate their beauty, in the Jewish tradition, what do? You say a blessing. When you see a beautiful sight in nature, we say, Oseh Ma'aseh Bereishit, God who created everything, Ma'aseh Bereishit, all of creation. So Tu B'Shvat is a reminder that the natural world is in fact the natural inhabitant of human beings, including Jews, that we really belong even more in a garden than we do in a study hall. But that also, when we're in the garden, we remember, if you will, the one who created it, the ultimate gardener. That is God, who gave us this wonder and this beauty to appreciate. And even though I don't think that they realized it, when they handed us in the yeshiva that old hard piece of carob to gnaw on as we went home, that was the lesson they were trying to teach. That the world is the most beautiful expression of the most beautiful. So remember, don't only pray in synagogue. Indoors is good, but God's world is better. Shabbat shalom.